The Great Barrier Reef needs to be fighting fit to cope with climate change. While the world takes action to address climate change, improving water quality is the best thing we can do to increase the reef's resilience. Runoff from the neighbouring catchment can cause all sorts of problems when pollutants end up in delicately balanced reef ecosystems. In this podcast series, we talk to farmers, scientists, extension officers, and local experts to hear their water quality perspectives.
My name is Juan Ortiz. I work for the Australian Institute of Marine Science. I'm a marine ecologist and an ecosystem modeler. And I mainly work looking at the effect of different disturbances on coral reefs and modeling what the future may look like for them. My interest in science started when I was in high school, and it was a bit of a mismatch because I was odd in the sense that I like math, but I wasn't very good at it. And I liked it because I could understand ideas and make them up in my mind and sort of abstractly figure where things were going, but I couldn't write them down very well. So in the tests, I wasn't doing very well. But all my teachers were saying, you should be a mathematician. I was like, well, but I almost fail every test. And I said, yeah, well, yes, we'll have to work on that. But you have that mind. So that started to sort of give me sort of interest in that. And then when I finished high school, I went and did a diving course. And I started diving. And then I fell in love with the sea and with corals. And very quickly, most people, when they started diving at my age, that was back in Venezuela, they got fixated with big fish and stuff like that. But very quickly, I got fixated with corals and colors rather than moving things. So I guess that's when all started. And a bit after that, I decided to do biology at university in Venezuela. And I did that. And even though when I started, I had not decided that I was going to do my thesis on corals, I ended up doing that. And I was quite involved with the scuba diving club in the School of Biological Sciences there. So we did a lot of diving. And it was very different because at the time, it was all free. The university wasn't allowed to charge you for anything. So we have to figure out how to do it. We didn't have much money, so we used to go with very poor equipment and not much resources and go to beautiful places, but very limited. But that made it really precious, so it made me sort of fall in love more and more with it. And then seeing it, how it wasn't doing that great, made me think, well, maybe I should start looking at it and think about it a bit more. Then I came to Australia and did a PhD with Ophi Goulburn in the University of Queensland, where I was kind of the odd one in the lab, because Ophi's lab is mainly physiology, and my PhD was all ecology, microecology, looking at things, how they die and grow. So I was sort of the odd one. And then I started doing some modeling, a postdoc I was doing back at UQ, looking at the whole ecosystem and how you can predict what happens with it or to it when we throw stuff at the corals. And very quickly, we started to get more and more results suggesting that the future wasn't looking very bright and that we had to do things to try and make it look better.
Could you tell us about modelling? Because it's come up a lot. I've been interviewing a lot of different people, especially farmers and people who aren't scientists and especially not mathematically minded. They struggle with the concept of modelling. How do you explain it?
So when people think of models, often they think of a very complicated thing where not even the person driving the model understands it and that gives you some outputs that you don't know how you get to them. And of course, there are some very complicated models that require a lot of people and perhaps not a single person can explain the whole thing. But the important thing for me to highlight is that there is nothing wrong with models and we couldn't live without models. And most of the time, people don't question what the models say. It's only when what the models say is perhaps not what the people is expecting to hear or is affecting their behavior and work through it. So you have to get a model to be able to take away the signal of other things you are not interested in and only look at the effect of what you are measuring or managing, which is, for example, how much nutrients are put in the water. So you can then get that thing of causality, which is something farmers are really interested in. Is it my nutrient that is actually increasing or reducing?
Do you ever get to talk to farmers in person?
I do, not as much as I like to. That's because we are all very busy. We have many things to do. The farmers are, of course, not very close to where we work. And also often that interaction, even though it's recognized as being important, it's not necessarily recognized as being a priority in both sides all the time. So I don't have as many opportunities. But when I do, I actually often enjoy it. And I like to say that they do enjoy it as well, not every time. But often I try to go from the human's perspective. We're both humans. We have things where we have challenges. They are common. And then from there, go a little bit more into the things we both, I mean, me and the farmers want to talk about.
They do want to know what's happening in their paddock, but I realise this is almost impossible for us to give us that specific information. So in some ways we're asking them to trust the process and the scientists who are giving them information.
We are, and sometimes we lose track, and this is something I think is really important. Scientists and policymakers and anyone that is not a farmer often see solutions as straightforward. Well, we have a problem. The water of getting into the EBR is not very clean. All we have to do is get it cleaner. That sounds a very straightforward problem and solution. It doesn't really work like that. And it doesn't work like that because we have to recognize that farmers are there because we need what they produce and because that's basically what they've done for years, and that's basically all they can do to survive. And they have families the same way we do and all that. And a behavioral change involves for them not only being convinced that what we are suggesting makes sense, but changing the whole way they work. And it has impacts both in their families and in their economy and in everything. So I think one of the reasons why perhaps we haven't got that involvement with the farmers and that change in behavior as quickly as we would have liked to, even though it's faster here than in other places in the world, but still, it's not as fast as we need it to be. And I think that has to do with the message and how we have tried to communicate things. And it has been historically very one-dimensional. We have some evidence that if you change your behavior, the reef will be better. That's kind of the picture we always send. That's a really broad message, right? That's the amount of trust and belief, literally belief as almost religious belief, that you are asking to put on you when you put such a broad statement is huge. People would not change their behavior in any other environment just if you just broadly come and say, yes, you do this, things are going to be better, and that's all we can say. And also, that's the other challenge, bombarded. We are all bombarded, and I'm partially responsible for that, with bad news about what's happening in the reef. And then we go a little bit on the psychology of it, which is something I really like, which is we, from the beginning, and it's not only in the marine space, but in management in general, often have gone the message sort of the wrong way around. When you look at the psychology, we try to make them look at the fact that they are doing something that is damaging the reef and showing how badly the reef is being damaged. Now, there is psychological research that has shown that when you provide that type of information, the emotions that you trigger is either guilt or anger. And guilt and anger tend not to lead to change in environmental behavior. It tends to lead to either the need for punishment, so they want someone to be punished, or the need for escape. So let's just get out of here and not be involved. If you actually craft your message in a way that it triggers pride, then the emotion that you actually trigger is pride, and the change in behavior is potentially maximized. So that's something I've been working lately to try to change the way we package information and we deliver it to try to actually trigger pride as opposed to guilt in the farmers or any stakeholder that we want or need for them to change behavior.
I'm interested in this step. You've taken a side step, I guess, from the core research you do into this area of science communication and psychology, and it's one of the reasons I wanted to talk to you today. How did that happen for you?
Well, that's a sort of a funny story, and it wasn't planned at all. So what happened was that about 2.5 years ago or so, I was invited to an event organized by the then chief scientist of Queensland for early career researchers. The chief scientist came and gave a talk, and we had a chat. And there were, I think, about 150 people from many different fields of science. And they said, well, we have a challenge for you. We are going to randomly allocate you into tables, so you don't know who are in your table. So we all went to tables, and then we were like, what are we going to come up with? And by chance, we ended up in a table where there was another ecosystem modeler and there was a medical scientist who works with the treatment of patients with chronic conditions. So when we started chatting, and the idea came up of, well, maybe one thing we can do is see whether we can apply principles from one field to a different field. And then we say, well, medical scientists have been looking at patients with chronic conditions for much longer than environmental management has even existed, right? It's been even for millennia. And because of that, they have a lot of information and they actually have done trials to look at what works and what doesn't work. We only had 20 minutes to come up with it. And what we found out is that once we started looking at it that way, there were many commonalities. And the first thing we sort of identified quite quickly is that it is quite reasonable, if you think about it, to think of the Great Barrier Reef, the reef in general, but in this case, the Great Barrier Reef, as a patient with chronic conditions. Because all the things we are trying to manage in relation to the Great Barrier Reef, even if we are successful, we're only gonna fix it in the long term. So it's like an ongoing management, right? So that's what you do with patients with chronic conditions. So that was the first thing. Once we identify that, then we went and said, well, let's look in the medical literature and see what they have found makes a big difference. And of course, there were a whole lot of drugs and things like that which don't apply. But one of the things that we realized that they found that the involvement of the family of patients with chronic condition has a very significant impact in the well-being of the patient and in the long-term recovery of the patient. And that had two components. It had one sort of emotional component, which is, well, the people were generally happier, and that means they were healthier. That bit we can't really sort of make an analogy with the reef because we don't know how to measure how happy the corals are or how happy a reef is. But the second component they studied was the fact that given the same treatment physically, they were actually doing better. And the reason why they were doing better is because they were having their medications at the right time all the time. They were eating better. So there were a whole lot of other things that were making it be better because they were supported by the family. When we noticed that, then we started to think, this is kind of similar to the Great Barrier Reef again. We always are in these big meetings with all these different stakeholders, and it's very broad, right? We have from the scientists looking at the reef, the managers trying to look at it, the politicians trying to make laws to protect it, all the way through the farmers that are somewhat related to it, the tourist operators that need the reef to use it, the miners that one way or another have to get their things through the reef to get it out, all the way to the large society which recognize the reef as important to them in Australia. So we said, well, what we have here is an analogy where we can consider all of those stakeholders as the family of the reef, and we can paint them in a map where you have very close family. We could be, let's say, the stakeholders that are more directly related to the reef, and very extended family that could be perhaps society as a large, the same way you have in a normal family. And then a lot of the analogies made a lot of sense because, you know, families have people that get along very well, and people that don't, they have big fights, they stop talking to each other, and then they talk again, but they have something that makes them stay together. And we thought that concept was quite powerful for something like the Great Barrier Reef. And then the next step was, well, that's great. We can do that, and we could just write a nice sort of emotional piece saying this is important. But if we just stop there, it's not going to make that much of a difference. What can we do to actually use this in a way that can make things easier for the management of the reef? And what we thought is that, well, once we identify that, we should look again in the scientific, in the medical and psychological literature to see what can we do differently to make sure that the concept of the family makes the biggest effect in the output of the management of the Great Barrier Reef. We look at two different things. We look at how important it is to trigger pride as opposed to anger or guilt. And we then look at a whole lot of research. We didn't do the research. We look at research that is already done that shows how to actually trigger pride. What you have to do, what kind of information you need to actually trigger pride. And what we came up with when we look at the whole research is that good news stories is what make the difference. And local good news stories are the best winners you can have because then you can trigger that pride the best. So we then look at how management is done in the GBR and what is the different players in the management of the GBR, the governance of the GBR, and we realize that we think there is a missing link there. There is a role that is not being fulfilled, and we call that role the role of the story scouters and crafters. We don't have anyone in charge of actively looking for good news stories that can be packed and presented and provided to the accession officers to make their work much easier and to make the system work better.
So what we've been proposing is to try to identify and fund that role and put it in the system so we can get a better output.
Do you have some examples of some good stories coming out of even the work you do?
We do. One of the reasons why we came up with this idea that we need someone looking at those good news stories is because they are not just going to appear. It's not just looking at the same data we look at and they will be there. And there's two reasons why. Remember, we are really interested in local good news stories, not good news stories. It's not, if we get a paper that said the reef is doing better than what we thought, that may be great and it may be great for society. It's not going to make farmers change that much because it's the same thing as a bad news story for the whole reef. Good news story for the whole reef doesn't really make that link of what they are doing. Those good news stories that are local are not going to often be generated by scientists because the scale is so small that they are researching that space is unlikely to lead to scientific papers. The reviewers are going to say it's too small. You can't generalize. There's nothing there, right? Now, there may be information that scientists produce that a bit of it can be used for that, but someone has to do that. And even just looking at things that are already out there. So we had a couple of examples. We have an example on the report cards that the government puts together, particularly the regional report cards. In general, in the report cards, they are all presented the same way. They have a little bit of a pie chart with colors where green is really good, red is really bad, and yellow is sort of in the middle. And historically, it has looked quite red because things are not doing that well. And even though we have had improvement, things won't go from red to green in one day to another. So you don't see a whole lot of green in there, right? And in those, it's usually like a pamphlet with different pages, and you have a whole lot of different graphs like this for different parts of the area. And we have found that in some of them, you have one for aquaculture, and that has been green, and it's been green for the whole time. However, it's one little circle green in the whole thing. The government cannot really make a big deal out of it, because if they did, they would look like they are trying to spin a positive out of a sea of red. But when we look at it a little bit more, then we went to some web pages, we went to even to WWF web page, and they said that the most sustainable prawns in the world are coming from those areas where that little bit of green is there. Now, that's local. So if we were to campaign that, we could probably make other people in that area, even not aquaculture people, but you know, tourist operators, I mean, farmers feel proud of that because it's their own area. And then that could actually influence what they do.
I would like to come back to your science to talk about what you're discovering about water quality in corals. An element of your science we could include.
Yeah. We published a paper just recently. You can see it as a good news or bad news depending on how you want to present it. What it shows is that the GBR as a whole is actually recovering after disturbances much slower than what it used to. It shows an 80% decline in the ability of the reef to recover after disturbances, which is alarming, of course, because we know reefs naturally get disturbed. It's really important that they can recover before they get disturbed again. If you lose 80% of that capacity, that's big trouble, right? Of course it is. We have to do as much as we can to fix that problem. When we got really excited is when we started to look with environmental data to see what was driving that reduction in recovery rate, we found that a significant proportion of it was driven by water quality. We also found in the actual data we had that we couldn't discriminate sites that were recovering better because they had better water quality. And then using the model, we could actually look at what happened if we improved water quality, and we could notice that a whole lot of risk could be flipped from negative recovery after a disturbance to positive recovery just by improving water quality. So that was quite refreshing because even though we started with a pretty bad news story, we ended up being quite excited because it's something we can do and we know how to do. So it's like there's a roadmap and we know what we need to do and now we know it works. So that's very empowering, I think, because it shows that it's perhaps one of the first time that we can see that it's actually worth the amount of effort from both government and stakeholders to make the difference with water quality. And the other positive aspects I've seen recently is that we have been looking at how important different type of corals are for that recovery rate, because we are really sort of fixated now with recovery rate, because we know we can't prevent disturbances, but we have to preserve that ability to recover. And with some data that is not published yet, we have found that a type of coral, the plate corals, the corals that look like a table or like a plate, they are really important for recovery. If they actually kick in early in that recovery period, the reef recover 10 times faster than if they don't. And what we are doing now is working together with Gabrumpa
to try and build a case to give them special management status within the Great Barrier Reef. What that would mean is that then Gabrumpa and the Office of the GBR can actually tailor their management strategies to make sure that they do as much as they can to get those important corals to come back after disturbances. And the other really important thing is that they are really sensitive to water quality, which means if you improve water quality, the benefit in terms of them coming back is really, really measurable and significant. So those very recent things we are doing as we speak that are directly related to water quality, good news stories, and the positive impact that improving water quality can have.
What is actually happening to the corals when there's pollutants in the water?
So the link between the health of the corals colonies as well as the health of the reef as the accumulation of colonies together in a site is multiple. Traditionally, the ones we have studied the most, because they are the more obvious, is mortality, all right? So if you have, let's say, pesticides there, we thought that quite likely pesticides are likely to be bad for corals. We did some experiments. This is back in the day. We noticed, yes, if you put pesticides in the water, they die. And then we started studying what concentration needs to be in the water for them to die. And we have some information of that. However, that effect, even though quite dramatic, if it's high, you need high concentrations of pesticides and it tends to dilute quickly. So it doesn't affect a huge area of the GBR, but it's mainly the catchments very close to the reefs. And the same way, there have been a lot of studies that have looked at what happened with sediments, right? Sediments actually stay on top of the corals and they can die because they suffocate and also affect the recruitment of new corals, because if you are full of sand, the corals cannot actually recruit and survive there. So that's a direct impact. But again, it tends to be limited to inshore reefs, which is something we knew. Now we are looking to one more pathway, which is quite promising in terms of how much benefit it could get, which is growth rate of corals. Now, corals actually live in a symbiosis with little algae that lives inside their tissue, and about 75 to 80% of their energy comes from the photosynthesis that the algae inside the tissue does. So the algae actually transform the light from the sun into organic compounds, and a lot of them go into the coral. The coral cannot live without that. It just cannot eat enough to produce the beautiful reefs we have. What we have noticed now is that when there are big wet seasons, the light in the reef, the light that the reef gets to see, can be half for up to a year and a half after a wet season because of the things that are there in the water, the combination of nutrients and sediments. When you think about that and you again go to that idea of recovery, that means that if you had a reef that had low coral cover because it had a bleaching event or a cyclone, and then you have a year and a half with half the light, that actually means less than half the growth. And if you are starting, you need that growth. That's why those corals are so important, because they grow faster than most of the corals. So that's a direct link, and that's a link that has been shown to affect not only inshore reefs, but also mid-shell reefs, so a much bigger proportion of the GBR.
Thank you, Juan, for your time.
No worries. Thank you very much.